This program is sponsored by Cane Vineyard and Winery. For more information, go to cane5.com.
I'm Grace Bonney, and you're listening to After the Jump. We're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to us live every Monday at noon on heritageradionetwork.com or download the podcast on iTunes. Today, I am very happy to be talking with Eric Demby and Jonathan Butler, the co-founders of the Brooklyn Flea and Smorgasburg. So I want to find out first how you guys met each other.
Well, we met each other, as you mentioned. I started a blog called brownstoner.com in early 2005, and which is primarily about Brooklyn real estate, but really sort of the biggest local blog for Brooklyn and covers really anything that anyone who cares about Brooklyn or has a stake in it, you know, would want to know about. But I met Eric in 2007, I think, when Eric was the communications director for the borough president. And I went to some event, and we started talking, and I guess so. We met a couple times when I had the idea for the Flea in 2007, and when I announced it, Eric said, "Gosh, you know, I've been thinking about doing something like this. Great idea, let's talk." And we went out for drinks, and kind of over about 45 minutes, we decided we should work on this together, and it's turned out to be a great partnership.
So how did you come up with the idea for the Flea? I mean, I think it's not a normal flea market. It's an incredibly well-curated flea market. Was that something that you had in mind from the beginning?
I mean, I think that very early on it was. The idea for the Flea was really just, I moved to Brooklyn in 2003. It always struck me as silly that Brooklyn didn't have a big flea market, given the mix of creative people and slightly, you know, kind of people who would want to find things used and use their own eye to pick things out. And so I guess, 2007, I did something called Salvage Fest, that September, as where I got a bunch of architectural salvage dealers, which is what I was into at the time, as kind of test the waters. And it was really popular just after posting about it on my blog. And that was kind of the impetus. And there was a location in Fort Greene near where I lived, and the city councilwoman was very helpful in helping make that happen. And, you know, I think Eric can talk more probably about the curatorial side of it, but I think early on we did decide that what was going to set this apart was curating the mix of vendors, not just having, you know, tube socks and detergent there.
Tie-dye dresses.
Right. And so even in the beginning when we weren't, you know, I guess we were always careful in the beginning, even if it meant having a few empty spaces early on while we were ramping up, not to just take anybody. You know, Eric can talk more about that because he does day-to-day a lot of that, figuring out who's going to be in the mix.
Well, one thing I want to know from Eric too is how involved was the city from the get-go? I mean, I know you've got that in the back. You're shaking your head like they're not involved at all. Was there any sort of city support or backing? Because it seemed like such a well-supported project, like straight from the beginning.
It's very much, you know, a private enterprise. In terms of the city, I would say that there was always support. As Jonathan mentioned, the city council person from Fort Greene and Clinton Hill, Tish James, was, you know, supportive in making the introduction to the Catholic high school where the Fort Greene Flea is. And I think, you know, she saw the potential for something like what we thought it might be to be successful. I mean, the reality is that before the Flea started, it was not a known entity. And so we didn't have a huge amount of support because it wasn't this popular thing that it is now. It was just an idea. And lots of people talk about doing crazy things and big things, and they talk a big game, and then, you know, it starts and nobody comes. My most previous experience before doing the Flea was as Jonathan mentioned, working as the communications director for Marty Markowitz, the Brooklyn Borough President. So, and Jonathan, through Brownstoner, had a lot of knowledge of how the city works. And so we were smart enough to, like, go to the Department of Health before we opened and say, we're going to have food vendors at the Flea. How does that work? So we can do it right. We get our permits from the right city agencies. And, we just sort of, like, reached out to people that we thought would be interested and supportive in advance, which is something that I learned from working for Marty, is important to get support rather than people learning about it after the fact. Working for Marty had its advantages, I suppose, in knowing how government works, but it wasn't like it gave us this big leg up, you know?
Yeah, I think, though, we did, you know, I guess we may not have imagined that it would get as big as it has, but we definitely, you know, thought it was a good idea, and we wanted to start it on the right foundations. We didn't want it to start getting popular and then all of a sudden, you know, when it landed on the front page of the New York Times, somebody say, oh, you didn't get your permit or whatever. So we wanted to really have the building blocks of the business in place correctly.
So I want to know how you guys chose the locations too, because I love, you mentioned the Catholic high school. So you, one of the locations you use is the Catholic high school in Fort right. Greene, and you also use the waterfront in Williamsburg, and you've also used Hanson Place, an amazing building yeah. in downtown Brooklyn.
And we were underneath the Brooklyn Bridge.
And under, I forgot
in
about that.
In 2009.
That's right.
Yeah.
How did you guys go about choosing at least the neighborhoods before the locations?
The neighborhood was really, the location in Fort Greene is, I don't know, 6-7 blocks from my house. And so I wanted to do something in the neighborhood, and this was just, it's a big, it's 40,000 square feet, and it's square, and it just seemed like the obvious place to do it, really. And so when I mentioned it to Tish, you know, she was supportive of it, and it worked nicely. The school, as an opportunity for the school to generate some revenues rather than the space just sitting empty all weekend. So that worked out well. Then I guess the other thing, Brooklyn Bridge, I can't remember exactly how that came about, if we approached them or they approached us.
I think they approached us, but I don't actually remember.
Yeah, but part of what we do, basically, you know, the real estate side of it is in some ways the greatest challenge, because it's the thing we have the least control over. And a number of locations, like the location of where we are in Williamsburg on the waterfront, is on a development site that wasn't developed because, you know, when the economy or the housing market fell apart in 2008, 2009, the developers had already built a couple buildings on the site, but the final plot they hadn't developed, and they felt it was important for their role in the community not just to let it sit there and be a mud pit for the next few years, and they wanted to activate it. And so that was a situation where, in fact, my knowing a lot of real estate people kind of came in handy, because someone said, oh, you should talk to the guys from the Flea, blah, 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 and that nicely worked out. But, you know, we don't know how long we're going to be there. So in some ways, we don't want the housing market to go too well. But, you know, we know we're going to be there for a couple of years. But, so it's often just kind of an organic, serendipity kind of thing.
I mean,
one
of the funniest things about the Flea in general, whether it's the real estate or the vendors, is that people are always like, how did you choose that place? Like you just asked us. And like, really, people just come to us and we filter out the responses. So we are actually, you know, surprising, maybe not surprisingly, but, you know, like brokers, property owners, they call us and they're like, hey, we want you to activate our space in, you know, the middle of nowhere. And, you know, we'll go and check it out. We spend a lot of time doing that because you never really know if you're like, oh, that doesn't seem like it makes any sense. And then you actually go there and you can kind of put together in your mind how something could work. So we spend a lot of time sort of assessing these opportunities and being like, well, it's really out of the way, but it has the benefit of a long-term situation or whatever. You know, we're, like the Flea is very much this like, I always make this comparison where the Flea is like an aircraft carrier as opposed to like a motorboat, where like if you want to change where it is, it takes months for people to figure it out. And then once you're there, you don't ever want to turn. You just want to keep going straight. And so that's always our biggest challenge. And it's actually the same thing with vendors. Before the Flea started, we both did this, but I did the vast majority of like reaching out to like antiques dealerships all over the region and meeting with people like you, trying to find vendors, you know. But now, really, people apply for that market, you know, like 5 or 10 people a day. And I just sit there and I comb through their pictures and their descriptions and I go, that sounds good. You're accepted. So the curating is really more of like a filtering.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, it's become something where we know people, and certain people that are connected to other people have an advantage of getting in and that kind of thing, because there's a level of quality that, and it's such a full market. But at the beginning, it was a lot of, you know, getting a vendor to show up, and actually the leverage was all on their side. They were all like, I'm going to come. And then the next day on Monday, they'd be like, your market sucks, I'm out of here. And so, you know, cause not that many people were coming at the beginning. We'd have these huge days, and then we'd have days where it was like, frankly, kind of dead. And I'd have to like be begging the vendors to stay. The first 2 years was a roller coaster. So now we have this like luxury of being mostly full and curating and all that kind of stuff. But really what happened is at the beginning, it was all about sustaining the good people. So the curating was really like figuring out what they wanted, promoting the hell out of the market every week and trying to get people to come and come and come. And then, you know, now 5 years later, everyone's like, oh, you guys are so, you know, you did such a great job. But the reality is that it's very, it was very challenging the first 2 or 3 years. It was really inconsistent, and it was not clear that it was going to be this thing that it is now, really, until Martha Stewart came.
Well, I feel like I've seen so many high-profile people. I now regularly receive press releases of people telling me which celebrity guests have been at the Brooklyn Flea.
Like who? Last
winter, my favorite was Anne Hathaway, was spotted at the Hanson Place Market, which was a big deal. I think all the bloggers got that email because it was deemed newsworthy. So I think you guys have officially made it.
Usher came last weekend.
Usher came. All right. Mm-hmm. Well,
Francis Ford Coppola came recently.
This is, you guys are stepping up your game.
We're not doing anything.
You're not doing anything.
It's not like I invited Frank or something.
I think the curation plays a big part in it, though. I'd like to talk about that some more. I mean, that's a really hard thing to do. I mean, I spoke with Eric last year when I set up a very tiny version of what you guys do in Portland, Oregon, and it was obviously clearly inspired by the Flea, and I had the hardest part was the pushback from people who weren't able to get into the market. What are sort of the guidelines you're using to curate? Is it mostly taste? Is it something that's based on the percentage of types of goods that are already sold there?
I think it's kind of, guys, I'll say the big picture about it, and Eric can talk more about the actual vendors, but it's a little bit like constructing like a stock portfolio or something. You know, where you, it's a mix of like bottoms up picking, where you just love a vendor or a stock or whatever it is, and you want them in the portfolio, but you also are looking at it from the top and you're saying, I don't want too many jewelry vendors, just as like I wouldn't want too many financial stocks in my portfolio. So it's this mix where you're kind of coming at it from both sides. You're not trying to be too strict on the top-down approach, but it's kind of a mix. You're always looking from the bottom and from the top, I think.
These days, it's it's evolved a huge amount from the beginning. Like I said, like at the beginning, it was the big challenge was finding antiques vendors who would not only sell but stick with it, because they, for them, it's a bigger commitment. Like it's more stuff, it's more physical labor, it's more there's more expense involved. And so, until the serious antiques vendors started being successful and spreading by word of mouth to other folks that our market was one worth doing, it was really challenging to get the stuff that people that came to a flea market expected to see. That stuff doesn't just appear out of nowhere, you know, and those people are like, they're a little more old school. Like, I wouldn't necessarily email them. It was more like, you know, they would have to come once, I'd have to go and talk to them and like, you know, sort of like court them really and flirt with them and all that kind of stuff and get them to stay, you know, be like, listen, it's going to get better. It's going to get better, all that kind of stuff. So antiques is always the heart and soul of the market. Generally, when folks that sell like legitimate antiques that are of some level of quality or diversity, they generally get in because there's a little bit more turnover with those folks. But you know, these days it's like we haven't accepted a vintage clothing vendor or a jewelry vendor in like 2 years because those things are so, there's so much of it already. So the curating is actually more of like a macro thing of like some percentage that we have in our minds of like how many of certain kinds of categories there should be. And also now that the food is so popular, there's more food at those markets. There used to be like 10 food vendors. And then in like 2010, we made this decision to really expand that part of it. And then, you know, in 2011, obviously, the food became so, there was so much food already in the market, and then so many more vendors that wanted to come in that were of high quality, that we actually started the smorgasbord to accommodate all those other food vendors. And so, in a way, the flea has sort of started to wag, the flea has become the dog that wags the tail. Like, people will start their food business and want to get into the flea to launch it, as opposed to before, where we were always sort of screening and reading, you know, food blogs and that kind of stuff to keep up with it. So the curating is like, it's a combination of like a long-term macro view and then getting really granular about being like, okay, you want to sell, cold drinks. What flavors of iced tea do you want to sell? 'Cause I already have a Brooklyn Soda Works and The Stand and, you know, and these other folks who make like fresh squeezed lemonade, or like there's so much, that everyone has their little niche there. And so it's all about protecting people from overlap now, which is, once someone gets in and becomes successful, it's about like protecting them and keeping loyal to them. So we make this mafia metaphor all the time because we don't have any signed deals with these folks, but we promote the hell out of our market and keep it successful. And they do a really good job and show up every week. And in exchange, we don't accept anyone who sort of like does what they already do. So that's how it is now.
So, all right, we're going to talk more about food after the break. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
I saw a
At Cane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to After the Jump on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I'm speaking with the co-founders of the Brooklyn Flea in Smorgasburg, Eric Denby and Jonathan Butler. So before the break, we were talking about food. I want to talk about food again because this I'm a home person, clearly, but the Smorgasburg has become like my favorite activity, not only because it's in my neighborhood, but because it's delicious. And it's also my favorite way to figure out what the cool kids are eating. I find that fascinating because that's where the long line is. And the cool kids are definitely into pulled pork right now. That line every weekend is insane, as well as s'mores, which I find fascinating that somebody could keep an entire business of just selling s'mores. But let's talk a little bit about the food. So that started last year. How did you guys decide to split off the food people into a completely separate market?
Well, that was actually driven by real estate. It's kind of funny that the developers who approached us to use this site wanted something to be happening there both days of the weekend. And we thought we were really looking for a new Sunday location for the flea market. And it became apparent that to keep them happy, to not blow our deal for Sunday, we really need to come up with something for Saturday. And we sort of went round and round. And in retrospect, it seems ridiculous that we just didn't in the first 10 seconds decide we were doing a food market. But we were playing around with, should we have more of a crafts market or an art market or whatever? And then one night we were just sending emails back and forth, and I think we decided it should be food, and the name kind of came to us, and and started doing it, and it's been fantastic. But it was really a matter of needing to come up with an idea to fill that time slot. And in retrospect, we had all this excess demand for the food, so it made a lot of sense, and it's obviously worked out very well.
Yeah, I mean, Smorgasburg is, so I've been going there a lot this year. I mean, I go there all the time, but it's actually changed this year, even since last year. It's evolved. Someone was asking me, like, what was the big promotion and marketing thing that you did over the winter that made it so much more popular this year? And I was like, we took it away. Like, we didn't do anything. And this happens with the flea, too, where the flea, even though it goes indoors in the winter, it sort of goes away. Like the vibe, the thing of the flea, which to me is really like the sort of like the experience of it, is similar when we go indoors, but it's not the same. And Smorgasburg didn't really go indoors technically this winter. And so by taking it away, what was actually a fairly inconsistent and debatably successful market last year, came back on opening day huge and actually has not stopped. It's like it's so big that we're actually a little worried about how big it's getting, to be honest with you. I mean, there's been a lot of people there the last few Saturdays, and the lines for food are really long, which is a bummer. But the we keep adding more vendors, and where last year we would have like 50 vendors on some Saturday and that was pretty full, we're up to like 100 now, and it's almost like the more vendors we add, the more people are coming and that kind of thing. So whether it's the New York Magazine cover article about the artisanal economy or like some less snarky stuff going on, like the moment in Brooklyn food is not like a trend anymore. It's just kind of like the new reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're sitting here in Roberta's, which is growing exponentially every day as well. Like, I think that it's just sort of like there's all this untapped demand, and we're just like, we sort of have found ourselves like somewhat at the middle of a certain part of it. And people just love to go and eat food. It's beautiful out there, and the food is, good and affordable, and people like to meet the people that make the food, and I don't know, there's just like a moment.
Well, I think it's really fortunate that we're all in Brooklyn doing that, because I think that sort of like artisanal food maker scene exists in a lot of other cities, but what doesn't exist in the other cities are the communities that are willing to sort of pay the price to support that, because mm-hmm. while it does seem affordable, like I can go and have breakfast there and it's cheaper than it would be to go to brunch, but it's still not cheap food, and with good reason. It's all made by hand. It takes a while. It's all made with love and care, but in other cities, people aren't willing to pay the same price for that. But Brooklyn is this interesting place where people sort of seem to understand and appreciate and be willing to pay the price behind supporting small makers.
Yeah, well, I also think, yeah, I think Brooklyn is sort of the perfect, for the same reason Brooklyn was so, there were so many blogs that started blossoming in Brooklyn when blogs were kind of the thing. It's a perfect, in my mind, it's always been this perfect intersection. It's got critical mass, but also a sense of community. And you don't have to give up either. It's not like, when you're in Manhattan, even, or other large cities, you might not feel that attached to your neighborhood or the community you're living in. But Brooklyn, people who live in Brooklyn feel so strongly about it, and they want to support local entrepreneurs and that kind of thing. But it's also just purely enough people around that you can have 100 food vendors, and everyone can still make it, you know, good amount of money that day. And so it's really kind of the perfect storm in my mind. And I think the fact that it's, versus some other cities, you know, everyone, people walk and ride their bikes a lot, and so it lends itself to this kind of gathering space. You know, we sometimes think of the Flea or Smorgasburg as like this sort of weird town square kind of thing, because a lot of people go because they want to eat or they want to buy stuff. But I think a lot of people, especially in the flea markets, it's kind of like the place they want to go and see people and be seen and bump into people they know and walk, just get out and kind of feel like they're in touch physically with their community. They might Monday through Friday sit behind their computer in this sort of virtual world, but on Saturday morning, I want to get outside with the kids and kind of connect. And it's kind of this place where people are connecting on a number of levels.
Well, I love that you said it's a place to be seen. One of the things that's sort of been taking me take back a little bit over the last couple of weeks is like what a scene it's become. I took a single guy friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, and I think I would say 4 out of every 5 girls that walked past had to be a working supermodel. It really was that type of crowd, and I felt completely out of place, but I think he was loving every second. And it really has become an audience where, you know, very interesting people come to be seen and to sort of show around, and that's an element. But the element that's most important to me, I think, is that it's a launching pad now, more so than a lot of other. I mean, we live in a town that has Etsy and Third Ward and places where people who have maker businesses have outlets for this. But I've seen so many interesting artisanal businesses, whether they're food or, you know, furniture makers, launch there. I mean, do you guys ever sort of sit back and think about what you've built?
Oh yeah, no, yeah. That's a big part of what. It's part of it, its success, but also part of what makes us feel good about doing it is this platform that literally hundreds of small businesses make their living on. You know, not, it's like, you know, this physical manifestation of something like Etsy. And so that's really, you know, that's been amazing to be a part of. And I think it also is important. It's gotten recognized, I think, sort of on a political level that it's serving that function too. And it has this sort of economic multiplier effect. It's not just, oh, let's have some fun on the weekends.
Yeah.
I think there's something like a little bit like it ties into things like crowdfunding and Kickstarter and the popularity. It's like participatory entrepreneurialism, which is too much of a mouthful to become a catchphrase. But the I think that when you're there, you feel like you're taking even if you're not a vendor, like you feel like you're taking part in this thing. So community is a word that gets thrown around all the time. But I think that you know, there's some definition of it that works really well at the Flea in Smorgasburg. And I think that when you're there, it's interesting because I think that was a big part of the Flea's success the first few years. I think that you're right that this year, for whatever reason, it's turning into an actual scene. Like, it actually feels like, so Miss Lily's, which is this restaurant on West Houston Street, it's like a Jamaican restaurant that Serge Becker opened. So it's like, you know, it has like a reggae radio station that's connected to it. I mean, it's like it's a definition of like coolness, you know, in a Manhattan sense. They started at Smorgasburg on Saturday. They have this giant jerk chicken barrel, and they do jerk, and they have this crazy like sound system that plays reggae 45s and all that kind of stuff, right? That is like, you know, and they set up like a little seating area. I mean, the fact that they came into the market and that they are serious about it and that they love it is like a symbol of something to me. And then when I'm hanging out there and they're like, Serge and his friends are like, man, this is the coolest spot in Brooklyn. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, that's not exactly what we set out to create, but it is becoming that now. And it feels like, I don't know, it's like an art party or like a, it's like, it's more like going out at night, but it's during the day. And I think that we're actually starting to get a little bit confused by that. It's not really what we intended, and we have no way of dealing with that, to be honest with you. We're really just like book the market and make sure that the security and the staff are there. And now suddenly we're like, This is a whole other bag of ball of wax, bag of worms, whatever it is.
Both are applicable.
Yeah.
I think you're fine. Well, before we end, I want to talk a little bit about expansion. So you guys just bought 9,000 square feet of space. That's the beer hall. That's separate. Okay.
Yeah,
so. Two big projects. Okay. Tell me about, first, let's talk about the Crown Heights building on Dean Street.
So I guess in March, with a couple partners, I bought a big old, this building in Crown Heights on Dean Street between Classen and Franklin was the old Studebaker service station. And we're in the process of converting that into, I call it creative office space. So probably a mix, you know, startups, artists, makers of jewelry and furniture, sort of depends. Well, that'll be opening next year. And on the ground floor, Eric and I are doing a 9,000 square foot beer and food hall on Bergen Street, also between Classen and Dean. It's going to be the anchor for this building. We are just in the process of, you know, working with the architects and the kitchen consultants, all that kind of stuff. But it should probably, once again, you know, feature a lot of local beer and wine. And we're about to open this. We're about to get a liquor license for Smorgasburg. We're going to be showcasing some local makers of spirits and wines and beers. And so it'll probably reflect that, as well as having a food court for some of our most popular food vendors. So look for that to hit around this time next year, I guess.
I mean, what are your sort of big goals? What are your big dream projects for the Brooklyn Play? I mean, expansion?
We, you know, our dream projects are sort of like, they're pretty much happening right now. I mean, the Flea and Smorgasburg are literally getting like 5,000 people to each of three markets every weekend. And a lot of times when other opportunities come up, we're like, there's no way that compares to what we're already doing. And so we just sort of like, the bar's really high for us to do other stuff. It's a lot of work to do what we're doing now. And the fact that they're like kind of peaking right now, you know, hopefully they're not peaking.
Because like, we also operate the food and beer concession at Summer Stage in Central Park. So that's a whole nother
just a small
thing.
Project on
just
the side.
A little thing we do every year for 50 shows for 6,000
people. There's a lot going on, right.
So we get really excited about things, but then we realize that we sort of stick with our core. One of the things that's most exciting is, like, for example, this beer hall is, you know, it's a bar with food, but it's also like a way for our food vendors to sort of graduate to the next level of their businesses. And I think that there's a lot of interesting things that could happen there where, like you were saying, that businesses are sort of launching at the markets. Well, a lot of them don't know exactly what to do next or where to go. And so I think that a lot of what we think about is like, how do we be part of that as well? Because it's a very interesting, exciting thing. You know, it's like birth, you know. And I think that, you know, birth is exciting and scary and all of those things. I think we think a lot about those things. We don't really know exactly what to do with it, though. But we feel like we're sort of like sitting on a big pile of something.
I would say that one thing that's great is that we do get a lot of new opportunities. We're always thinking about ways to expand. What I would say is that we've, as a partnership, gotten really good at chewing on these things, talking about them, and really... without exception, when something's right, we both end up, you know, we sit on it for a week or two and we basically end up knowing it's right, and we have, you know, we've always
agreed
on it.
It's a little bit like parenting, I've found. Sometimes you're like, you're both like kind of like, my son shouldn't do this. Yeah, he should. And then like the next day you're like, I think he should go to, you know, get a tutor. And you're like, yeah, I was thinking that too. Like there's a lot of these moments, you know.
Right. We reach consensus pretty successfully.
All right, I'm going to see if you can have consensus on our final question, which is, I want to know who your dream vendor is and who your dream buyer is. Like, who do you want to walk around and see? Or who do you want to see walking around, and who do you want to have selling one day? Dream big.
Wow.
Well, I can tell you some of the, like, Thurston Moore was there buying records last weekend, and that was, like, really awesome.
I was going to say, I think if Brian Eno came to our record fair, that would probably be up there.
Brian Eno at the record fair would be amazing. Yeah. And he was on our record fair design as a sort of hint to him that he's supposed to come to the next one, but I don't think he's going to see it. And then a dream vendor, that's a kind of a good question. I mean, it's hard because my favorite vendors are the ones that come out of nowhere. It's not like I'm like, I want Martha Stewart to sell a quilt. Like, I think you'd be a really good vendor, actually. I'd be curious. Although you were a vendor beginning, sort of. Let's see. There's probably someone who makes food. I think it would be really cool to get, like, that chef guy from Norway or whatever, you know, or, like, some... I love it when the really big chefs are like, I want to do this weird small side thing I've always wanted to do that I can't do in a restaurant. And then they, like, it's like Saul and the Vanderbilt, they have this, like, sausage stand at the Flea or whatever. These kind of, like, cool side projects. I think those are always the most fun and interesting because they sort of capture the celebrity aspect of food, but they bring it down to earth because people actually just want, they have their, it's about their passion. It's not about some like advertising scheme for them. But I don't have some like favorite chef of mine.
Okay. Well, I think that's pretty good. I think Thurston Moore buying records, you really can't get a higher compliment for what you put together. So we are out of time. Thanks so much for talking to us. I'm sure I will see you guys around the Flea. And for any of you visiting Brooklyn, you can visit the Flea every weekend on Saturday and Sunday. It's definitely the place to be seen and to eat great food and buy cool things. So thanks for being with us, guys.
Thanks
Grace.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.